I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio, and thank you for joining us again. Tracy Schultz, of course, is my engineer and compatriot here. Yeah. Tracy, what lane are we driving in?
the left lane?
The left lane, RAG Radio, driving in the left lane. You know, we had a break in the weather yesterday, didn't we?
A little bit, yeah.
It only hit 99. Today it's supposed to be 103. With the heat index at 108. So
wow. All right.
But there's a cold front is coming in this weekend, and it's only going to be in the low 90s.
Yeah. So things to look forward to.
Yeah. So those of you listening who are in other parts of the country, I guess a lot of places are hot right now because we're sort of in the middle of the summer. But
yeah.
For the rest of you, you can just be envious of us. You got that? So, okay. We come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on we're broadcast originally live on KOOP in Austin, and then we're rebroadcast by several other community radio stations around the country. Our shows are put up as podcasts at the Internet Archive and at Veterans Today and at the RAG Blog, and we have a wide audience. Our shows have legs, don't they, Tracy? Paws. They have paws. Anyway, we want to thank you, everybody, for being with us. RAG Radio is produced in conjunction with the RAG Blog and the New Journalism Project. Our guest today, Alan Weider, is the author of a new book, which is the first really comprehensive, I don't know if we're, he doesn't like to call it a biography, but it is, I think, Alan. And it's called Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, But Mostly Conversation. Alan Weider is an oral historian who lives in Portland, Oregon. He taught for 20-plus years at the University of South Carolina and also spent time at the University of the Western Cape and Stellenbosch?
Got it.
Stellenbosch, yeah. University in South Africa. In 2013, Monthly Review published his book on South African struggle leaders Ruth First and Joe Slovo and the war against apartheid. According to Weider, he has been writing his current book, Studs Terkel, about Studs Terkel in his head since the early 1990s. Drawing from over 100 interviews of people who knew and worked with Studs, Alan Weider creates a multidimensional portrait of a run-of-the-mill guy from Chicago who in public life became an acclaimed author and raconteur while managing in his private life to remain a mensch. So welcome to RAG Radio.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Thorne.
Yeah, it's cool to have you. And I should mention that Alan's writing has appeared on the RAG Blog, and so you can find the pieces that he's written at theragblog.com. Just search Alan Weider, W-I-E-D-E-R. So this is a fascinating book, and it's a fascinating history, and it's interesting because this is an oral historian writing about an oral historian. So. Of course, you know, Studs Terkel was a whole lot of things, and we'll talk about that. We'll talk about his life. I want to talk about you and your work. I want to talk about how you put this book together, because it's a fascinating combination of things. And I do want to read what. Okay, here we go again. Oh, Victor Novosky wrote, publisher emeritus of The Nation. He said, red checked shirts, red socks, and red, but also white and blue politics. Great listener who converted his interviewees into world-class talkers. Dissenter, idealist, visionary, prophet, petition signer, proud blacklistee. Says Weider's book brings it and him all back and reminds us that this so-called oral historian was much more than that. One of a kind, an inspiring, brave, and talented original. Woo!
Boy, that sounds great.
Yeah, let's read it. Have you read it yet?
You don't know how many times.
I bet. So tell me how, you know, it's interesting because you say you were writing in your head for a long time. How did you come about doing this?
So when I was in academia for a long time, and I did a dissertation, gosh, talk about that, but that finished up in 1977. And for all these years, I've thought that I could have never done that dissertation if Studs hadn't started writing books, because Studs sort of legitimized oral history in terms of American academia, even though it was and remains kind of a love-hate relationship. The Oral History Association, you know, they love that Studs has legitimized oral history, but then they condemn him for not being academic enough, you know, so it's kind of a back and forth, and I never had to go through that process of condemnation. And so...
Because you were always academic enough.
No, I was always Studs enough.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
I mean, that was always the dream, and it was right out of Studs, because the dream as an academic for me was that somebody would find an article on the bus or something and somehow find me and go, I really like that article because I could understand it. It wasn't in academies, you know. So that's Studs in a way.
Yeah, yeah. So would you say that he's an inspiration for you in terms of your work?
Absolutely, and in terms of my work, for sure. I only met him once, and I had just got back from South Africa, and he was going on stage, and we had about 15 minutes, and he was, this was in 2003, so he was already old, and he couldn't hear very well, and he was focused on what he had to do. And at some point I said, well, I just got back from South Africa, and he just lit up. It was, the interest was there. He was, you know, I was the only one in the room because he wanted to know what was going on because he had been there 40 years earlier.
But wouldn't we say that that's one of the primary characteristics is, I guess, as it said, how good a listener he was, that he always he was always right there with whoever he was interviewing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many people that said that to me as I did the book, people that knew him off stage, and then people like Navasky, like Bud Trillin, who he interviewed and talked about being interviewed by him about their books, was like being interviewed by nobody else, because he found things that they wrote that they said, oh my God, he found it much better than we ever knew it was. This is fabulous. You know, the way that he brought things out from people.
You know, I relate to all of this a lot, partly because I think one of the things we've done, and I'm certainly not an academic oral historian, but one of the things we've done with this radio show, with our, I don't know, 275, 280 episodes, something like that, is we've done a lot of oral history. You know, we've done a lot of stuff. We've had interviews with a lot of sort of iconic figures in early Austin history and whatever. And so it's exciting, although I know oral history per se is a very specific kind of discipline.
Yeah, I think so. But and that's what's interesting about Studs. I mean, he never referred to himself as an oral historian. I mean, when people said that, he kind of flinched, and when people called him a journalist, he kind of flinched, and you know, and he didn't do a label for it. And basically, it was, I talk to people, I have conversations, and the conversations, I respect the people that I speak with, and I hope that they respect me, and the conversations lead to another point, both in terms of individuals and also in terms of the collective. So I don't think he ever thought in those terms, and maybe that's why academics, you know, some academics, you know, didn't see it as legitimate.
Huh, that's interesting. Okay, tell us how Lewis Terkel became Studs.
Yeah, that's a funny story, and you know, he carried around the books on Studs Lonergan, Farrell's books, and he was in theater, and I don't know how much I go into this, but there was another Lewis, and he was always carrying around Farrell's book, and so somebody named it.
There was another Lewis in the cast, right?
Yeah, in the cast, he was in the Chicago Rep Theater, which was extremely political, and that's one of the reasons I think that it led him to become part of it. They were a theater troupe, and they didn't just play in theater facilities. They played in union halls, they played in bars, they played at street, you know, they did stuff in street demonstrations. His first the first play that he starred in was Waiting for Lefty, Odette's play. And then he later on, of course, talked about Odette's and the blacklisting and naming names. And all these things kind of weave together in his life.
You had said when you talk about the naming names and the blacklist, he was, you talk about the fact that he was not a communist, but essentially he was with the communists In terms of the politics, but not in terms of the organizational nonsense that went on.
Yeah, and I think I spend a good bit of time on that in terms of where was he in that time period? And there are some humorous things that came out of it. But it's interesting because as I developed that, I don't think I can claim to totally know. I mean, I tried to get at it. One of Studs' is very close friends was Quentin Young, who was a doctor in Chicago who fought his whole life for socialized medicine. And I don't know if Quentin was in CP or not. I know that he's quoted as saying that a lot of the people that supported Barry Commoner in 1980 that were part of the Citizens Party, and Studs was a third-party guy, a lot of the CP people, meaning Citizen Party, were in the other CP too. But Studs was interesting because, the union leader Ed Sulawski in Chicago said, "Nah, Studs wouldn't have been a member. He wasn't a member of anything. He was just involved in everything." And Studs' son Dan said, "Well, I don't know if he was or not, but he might have signed something, but he signed everything. So who would know?" And Studs had the line right. "I never met a petition I didn't sign." So it's hard to say, but what you said is totally right. I mean, the whole bureaucracy and the dogma. I mean, if Studs had a dogma, it was underdogism, and that's not a dogma. So
underdogma.
Yeah. So he wasn't a dogmatic guy, even though he could be strong and he could be very critical and hard, but it wasn't ideological dogma.
But he was blacklisted.
Well, he wasn't. The deal was he was really upset because some of his close political friends were called before McCarthy's committee, and he was never literally called. On the other hand, he lost his TV show because he wouldn't sign a loyalty oath.
Right. Well, we had our good friend, the late John Henry Falk, who was, of course, also a sort of everyman kind of radio guy and had lots of other... He was blacklisted and lost his show, but he fought him in court and won. So, which was...
And Studs loved him, by the way, which makes total sense.
Right.
But Studs, in retrospect, when he reflected on it, he was pretty convinced that he would have never named names, but then he softened in terms of some of the people later on in terms of their situation at the time, and. Every time there was a list, he was angry that he wasn't on it. He was angry that he wasn't on Nixon's list, and he couldn't. And when he looked at the people on the list, he was really angry in terms of, wait a minute, how could they be on the list and I'm not on the list in terms of Nixon's hate list? So there was always kind of he was very serious about the working man. And one of the things that I think the book does is that I don't think is common knowledge is how from the time of his youth, how strong he was fighting against racism in the United States.
Right. And we'll go into that. The book is Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, But Mostly Conversation. And the author and our guest is Alan Weider. We still have a couple of minutes before we go to break. It's so fascinating, his life trajectory. And you might give us a little kind of summary, because there are people out there who are listening who probably don't even know his story. So why don't you just sort of give us an overview and of how important he was?
Okay, and that can touch on some of the things that made him as an adult.
And of course, we'll go into specifics later. But
okay. So yeah, he was born in 1912 to Jewish immigrant parents. First New York, and they moved to Chicago when he was 12. And his parents ran a men's-only hotel. And one of the main forces in his life, and this is during the 20s and up until the early 30s, were the men that lived in this hotel and the debates that they had, many of them political, not all. And he was part of it. He listened to it. These men gave him books. He read the Haldeman series that came out of Kansas with all the, these biographies of famous people. And then the other part of his youth was a place called Buckhouse Square, which is known in Chicago for radical politics as well as kind of crazed speeches. It was a place like Hyde Park in London where people got on soapboxes and made speeches. And Studs was young, but he made a point of being there. And he, as a youth and then as a young man, was affected by this leftist politics. His heroes were Eugene Debs. His hero, the Wobblies, were very important to him. And he's written about all of this stuff. And then he went to the University of Chicago for undergrad and law school and never became a lawyer, and wanted to be an actor. And even though he also looked for 9-to-5 jobs, and as I said before, got involved in the Chicago Repertory Theater, which was a very, very political, progressive group. And then also in FDR's, it was called the Illinois Writers Project. It was part of the National Writers Project. And these, the people at Richard Wright was one of the writers. Nelson Algren was another writer. And what touched Studs about it so much was the collective nature of things, of being part of a community that believed in social justice. That would be the word now, probably not then. And this was through the Depression that he was involved in that, and involved in everything, involved in black music. When he went away for a year, he joined the service, which we can talk about that. It's kind of the irony of that. But he joined the service, and he was only in for a year in World War II, and he sort of got thrown out. Touching people like Billie Holiday, and then coming out of the service and deciding that he was going to be a disc jockey, and he did everything on radio. And then the big thing, and this can lead to after the break, the big thing was, because of his radio popularity, he became the head of one of the three Chicago TV shows. It was known as Chicago Television. And all three of them were slated to go to New York. One was Garraway at Large. The other was Kukla, Fran, and Ali. And Studs Place. Studs Place was took place in a kind of a greasy diner. And the waitress wore union buttons. And the actor David Schwimmer, who became close with Studs, that's kind of an odd relationship, but he became close to Studs. And he always referred to Studs Place as... Cheers is written by Clifford Odets, but kind of a wild thing.
Yeah.
But basically, that's the blacklist stuff. You know, one of the NBC execs came to him and said, "You know, you've signed all these petitions. You've shown up at left wing events. You're always on the program, and you have to say you were duped." And Studs was like, "No, I'm not doing that." And again, in reflection, he said, "Okay, so was it more? I know I believed in the things I did, but was it more my own vanity, my own pride? How dare you ask me to say I was duped? I could never be duped. I've got too much pride for that." So basically, he was jobless going into the 50s. He didn't have a job, and he had been married in 1939. Which I talk about in the book, and Ida was a social worker. His wife Ida was a social worker, and she supported the family. But early in the 50s, he became a radio guy in Chicago and had a show that became the Studs Terkel Show at a station called WFMT, where he worked for 45 years, which to me is an amazing thing. Right. I mean, to be at a radio station for 45 years is right. Almost incomprehensible.
Okay, we're going to need to take Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, my God.
Yeah.
Wow, how wonderful. I hadn't thought about them in... I don't know when I last thought about them. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Alan Weider, and we're talking about Studs Terkel. We'll be right back. Thank you.
give you all of my love, and so now what more can I do?
All right, Big Bill Brunsey, Tracy.
Yeah, yeah, it's a classic. That was 1934, his version of C.C. Rider.
Okay, Alan Weider's our guest. We've been talking about Studs Terkel. And that was one of the things you suggested that we play, or Big Bill Brunsey, not that particular cut. Was that partly just because you thought it evoked the time or specifically related to Studs?
No, they were friends,
they were close.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm not surprised at that.
And not only were they close, I mean, Studs had a handful of people that he would actually refer to as his teachers, and Big Bill Brunsey was one of those people.
Okay. Right. Well, Big Bill Brunsey was a pretty important figure in his own right.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, Studs.
Go ahead.
Studs, like I mentioned before the break, Studs, you know, with Studs and fighting against racism, and one of the things that Studs did in terms of, Studs was very reflective about ideas, and there was an incident he was touring with Bill Brunsey and his friend Win Strachey, who was from the Old Town Music School. And in fact, Studs and Wynn referred to themselves in the 50s as what was the phrase? I'm not thinking about it. They were both harassed during the McCarthy era, and so the Chicago Two. They referred to themselves as the Chicago Two, but they were on the road and they stopped. They were going to do a gig at Purdue University. And they came outside of a kind of a restaurant bar type place, and Brunsey said, "Will you guys bring me back a ham sandwich?" Because he knew they wouldn't serve him. And Studs and the other people said, "Oh, come on, you're prejudging. These are good. These are working people." And they went in, and of course they wouldn't serve him. And so, you know, and Bill sort of chuckled as opposed to crying, you know, and it was kind of one of these lessons. And Studs had a number of those during his life that really affected him greatly.
Before we go any further, we have something we want to listen to.
Okay.
This is Studs Terkel. Tracy, you got that up?
What has happened to the human voice? Vox humana. Hollering, shouting, quiet, talking, buzz. I was leaving the airport. This is in Atlanta. You know, you leave the gate, you take a train that took you to the concourse of your choice, and I get into this train, dead silence, few people seated, all standing. Up above you hear a voice that once was a human voice, but no longer. Now it talks like a machine. Concourse 1, Fort Worth, Dallas, Lubbock, that kind of voice. Just then the doors are about to close, pneumatic doors, when a young couple rush in and push open the doors and get in. Without missing a beat, that voice above says, "Because of late entry, we delayed 30 seconds." The people looked at that couple. As if that couple just committed mass murder, you know. And the couple is shrinking like this, you know. And I'm known for my talking. I'm Gabby. And so I say, "George Orwell, Your time has come and gone. I expect a laugh. Dead silence. And now they look at me. And I'm with the couple, the three of us, at the Hill of Calvary on Good Friday. And then I say, my God, where's the human voice? And just then there's a little baby. Maybe the baby's about a year old or something. And I say, sir or madam, to the baby, what is your opinion of the human species? Well, what does a baby do? And the baby starts giggling. I say, thank God, the sound of a human voice.
Okay, that'll give you a sense of Studs Terkel, I think. We're talking with Alan Weider, who's the author of Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, but Mostly Conversation. That was wonderful, wasn't it? Alan, you were talking about Big Bill Brindze and about the civil rights involvement. I just thought we had to stop for a second and actually hear the man there.
Actually, it's such a great clip, and he chose it when StoryCorps came to his house. I think it was 2001, but don't hold me to that. And when they there was the first and last time they've ever actually gone on the road and gone to somebody's house to record them, and that was the piece that he chose. And for listeners, you can go online, and StoryCorps actually animated that, and so they drew Studs. It's fabulous to watch the animation as he talks. But I think it touches. It's so strong because on the one hand, Studs was very critical in terms of what America is, and conversation and democracy for him went together. On the other hand, he never left. You know, he never lost hope, and he wrote about that, and he found people like that, and that was the baby. Obviously, you know, that was the baby. There's a smile, and there's hope, and he found that in so many people that he interviewed for his books over the years.
Yeah, I think the most remarkable thing. Oh, I noticed that I was looking at One History, and they talked about the fact that that among the people he interviewed were Martin Luther King, Leonard Bernstein, Mart Saul, Bob Dylan, Dorothy Parker, Tennessee Williams. I mean, it's, you know, those are just precious. Those are priceless.
Absolutely.
And the way he did his interviews, he may be as famous as any person who's done that kind of thing in this country's history, I think.
Yeah, and I think other people take that on. You know, there are other interviewers, and there's filmmakers that go, you know, I would have never done this if it wasn't for Studs. There's all kinds of people that talk about Ken Burns. I spent a long time interviewing Ken Burns for the book, and he said Studs' work made his work possible. And he also had Studs as a talking head.
That's what I was going to. I actually was going to bring that up. Tell us about that. Studs, yeah, and baseball.
Yeah, for a number of series, but the main one was baseball, and Studs just told amazing stories in that. The one was he did this thing. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but it was he was talking about when Babe Ruth hit the fabled home run that supposedly he pointed to center field where he was going to hit it, and he said, "My God, the number of people that say they were at that game were at that game. Wrigley Field holds a million." They weren't together, but it was kind of interesting because Studs, who was a labor guy all his life, and viewed Marvin Miller, the head of the initial head of the baseball's union, as kind of legendary, but he was against free agency, and he was against free agency because he thought that it ruined community. And then on the other hand, in the series was George Will, who said he was a socialist on the issue because players should be the ones that get the money. So go figure, right? I mean, in terms of stands that people take.
Right. All right. So I mean, that's fascinating because Ken Burns is one of our great historians, I think.
Absolutely. And it would be interesting to see Studs and some of the newer ones. You know, I pretty much every day now when I hear Trump or Hillary talk, I wish Studs was around so that I could hear him comment on it, especially with his third party mentality, yet step backs, you know, like in 2000, you know, he was a big Nader guy, and he emceed Nader when he came to Chicago, and he riled up the crowd. And then a week later, he wrote in the Chicago Tribune, well, you know, I'm a big Nader guy, and I've always been a third-party guy, but I don't know about this Bush guy. Maybe if you live in a contested state, you should vote for Gore, you know? So all that stuff. But I wonder, some of the latest historical pieces, that like the Roosevelt piece, I would have loved to hear what Studs thought about those, some of the later Ken Burns documentaries.
Right. He was at the 68 Democratic Convention, right?
Yeah, definitely. He was in the park during the protests and was tear gassed, and he was with James Cameron, who also was one of his heroes, the British writer who was sort of demonized by the American press as a communist, and they actually became very close friends, and they spent 3 nights together in the park and were tear gassed by the Chicago Police Department. And he wrote about it. He wrote about it in a number of his books. And he also, of course, he also interviewed our generation, more of our generation of 60s activists. And that's an interesting story.
Tell us that, because did he have sort of a mixed view of 60s of the 60s and of the activism? I mean,
I mean, it's interesting to me because he knew a lot of the people from SDS and also from Weather Underground. He knew the SNCC people. He had these people on his show. His wife Ida, when Fred Hampton was murdered in 1969, sat vigil at the Black Panther offices at 3 a.m. because they were worried that the offices might be attacked. I mean, he was very, very involved. And in fact, in 69, he wrote a thing about that maybe the Weathermen were actually formed because of the way the Daily treated the protests at the 68 convention. But I have a little piece that, if you want, I can read. I don't know if it might take too long. I don't know about that time, because I think I write about that, and I think it's an interesting kind of sequence with the people that have commented on that.
Okay, do it.
Okay, and just cut me off if I'm going too long, and then I can talk the rest through.
Okay, you've been kind of long now, so no, go ahead. Alan Weider, go ahead.
Okay, in reversal of roles, Studs was interviewed by Dennis Bryan for his book, Murders and Other Friendly People. He again spoke about the 1968 Democratic Convention and the subsequent Chicago 7 trial, this time warning young people to observe Mayor Daley and Judge Hoffman. Quote, I think that Richard J. Daley and Julius Hoffman are the two greatest teachers the young have had since Socrates, because they made them know themselves. What was greater teaching to a newspaperman than a club on the head by Daley's boys and Hoffman's incredible behavior in the courtroom, you see? End quote. The late 1960s were somewhat of a conflicting time for Studs. While he supported the anti-war movement, he was confounded by the generation of Students for a Democratic Society and Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Rick Ayers remembers Studs' words from their first meeting in the early 60s. I'm trying to understand, you know, I'm an older guy. I'm trying to understand your generation. Studs' colleague at WFMT, George Drury, reports that the 1930s, not the 60s, were formative years for Studs. But like Ayers, he recalls Studs being both curious and sympathetic towards the decade's activists. He would be there and very simpatico with the line of progressive, socially aware, socially committed anything, and little things, like when Abby Hoffman died, and he'd had Abby on his show. Studs came into the library, and he wanted to know where John Prine's Sam Stone was, the song. And I was like, well, you know, Studs, Roger McGuinn has a song called Partners in Crime about the Chicago 7. he wound up using them both. And this is the flip now. This is about Tom Engelhardt, who was one of Studs' editors. Tom Engelhardt held different memories and reflections. He edited some of Studs' books and noted that there were a good number of 1960s generation people in Hope Dies Last. I felt he was the weakest on people from the 60s, my generation. I used to think about this because I felt that there was something that Studs didn't understand, didn't quite know what to make of the kids who came out of the good times, the golden age of the 50s. He was sympathetic. He liked them. But there was something in the 60s generation, some deep thing that he just didn't get. He got perfectly good interviews out of them, but they weren't his best. That's my opinion. I was very aware of this as an editor. I was aware that these were the interviews you had to work hardest on because they somehow lacked something. They were good, well-spirited, well-intentioned, but they just didn't have the emotional depth that Studs got from everybody else. End quote. In actuality, this is the last paragraph, in actuality, Studs was friends with many of the Times activists, including veterans of SDS, Weather, and SNCC. With reference to generations, it's helpful to recall one of the lines Studs often used. They didn't sing the same songs. And so the generational thing is really interesting, and he talked about that a lot in his life, I think.
Right, right. And maybe there wasn't as much sense in the 60s of the traditions of the left because there was a lot of, part of it was a breaking away from those traditions.
Absolutely.
So that's interesting.
Absolutely.
I have to point out that Mayor Daley's thugs weren't able to get to me to hit me on the head, so I didn't.
because of your speed, or
I was never very fast, so I don't. I levitated, and so they didn't. Just like we levitated the Pentagon. So.
It sounds right.
Yeah, doesn't it? So okay, my guest is Alan Weider. We're talking about Studs Terkel and his book, and Alan's book, Studs Terkel: Politics, Culture, but Mostly Conversation. This is Rag Radio. We'll be right back.
Digesting Reader's Digest in the back of the dirty bookstore. A plastic flag with gum on the back fell out on the floor. Well, I picked it up and I ran outside, slapped it on my window shield. And if I could see old Betsy Ross, I'd tell her how good I feel. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. Morning, and the cashier said to me, if you join the Christmas club, we'll give you 10 of them flags for free. Well, I didn't mess around a bit, I took him up on what he said, and I stuck them stickers all over my car and one on my wife's forehead. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore.
John Prine, which reminds me, my guest is Alan Weider. Studs Terkel is the topic. And listening to John Prine there, I know that Terkel called himself an agnostic, but he said that that was actually a cowardly atheist.
I love it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He and Mike Royko were very close, weren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, very, very close. And they came through for each other all the time. They wrote for each other. Royko, and they had to stand up for each other over the years when each were attacked by other journalists and just people, you know, some people in general. And I don't mean that happened all the time. It happened more to Royko than it did to Studs. But and it's interesting too, because Studs stuck with Royko. Royko's, you know, his point of view sort of changed before he died. He became much more conservative. But they were friends. and the, it was a threesome in a sense. It was Studs Royko and Nelson Algren.
Yeah, really. So what is it about Chicago anyway? You know, even the famed Barack Obama Bill Ayers duo.
Yeah. We only wish that Barack had been more like Bill, but that's my view of the world, right?
Right. So no, but it is very interesting that the Chicago, because I've got lots of old friends there, and a lot of them were old SDSers, you know, people like Mike James and Bill and Bernadine and all those people.
Right.
But Chicago always had this kind of literary left scene, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and Studs, when he was young, in the 20s, you know, just living in the Tower Town section where there was the People's Bookstore, Radical Bookstore, and you know, growing up on Carl Sandburg, you know, as well as the Wobblies. I mean, both of those things and feeling comfortable in it and learning from it. And I think, you know, that carries on. I mean, you know, you think about somebody like Bill Ayers, who had offers, and Bernadine too, to leave Chicago for much fancier academic stuff and always said no. I mean, this was, it's a home. And I think, as you know, I'm not a Chicagoan, but every time I go to Chicago, there's something that you feel, that you know, it's a town where, I mean, this sounds so romantic, but it's a worker's town. And then on the other hand, it's not. Then you've got Rahm Emanuel, you know, and I think it's always been that way. Studs referred to it in his book on Chicago as what, the double-headed Janus, the city.
Right, right.
And he wrote, and he, you know, I took this thing from him of, you know, he just did these contrasts, boom, 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 of all these contrasts of this great, horrible place.
It's always been kind of amazing in that sense, in terms of the contradictions, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, think about this. Studs, I mean, Royko outed him on this, but Studs hated the Cubs. And it was Cubs fans who were his fans, you know?
No, I can't believe it. No, yeah. Don't tell me.
Because of race. Wrigley was a racist.
Right, he was too, wasn't he?
Yeah, and that they were like 5 years later than the Giants in signing an African American player, and of course Royko would tease him about it too. He said, "Oh well, your beloved WMFT. Now when did they hire you?" Know, that kind of thing. But,
okay, all right. Something that you mentioned in a note to me, you said that you wanted to talk about Turkle's belief that conversation and democracy are wed. Tell me about that.
Yeah, and I think it goes together with the clip that you played. You know, that Studs, when he played that clip, he often said, you know, we live in a time where there's no longer debate. There's no longer real conversation. We just get snippets. We get sound bites. We don't really argue and have conversations that have meaning. And he always believed in those. And I think he learned that from what I talked about earlier, from the time when he was a teenager growing up in this hotel, and then his political activity. And I think he believed that without conversation, you can't have democracy. There has to be real conversation with real people, which also is probably why he was a third party guy. And I have to credit, there was a younger, meaning our generation, friend of Studs named Jamie Calvin, who Studs referred to as a guerrilla journalist. And Jamie's still very active fighting against police brutality in Chicago. He runs a place called the Invisible Institute. And Jamie's the one that put me onto that. It was that the meaning of conversation for Studs, that conversation was so important. And it didn't make it stiff. It didn't make it always have to be serious. But the conversation is about ideas and life is what leads to a democratic society, and it has to be part of a democratic society. And, you know, when you look at our political system and the party system, of course, there's no such thing as conversation. There's just bullying and power on whichever party it is. So, and I think that's what led him. I mean, I think that's why he supported the people that he supported throughout the years.
Okay, you're going to do another reading for us, right?
Well, yeah.
And I think we have something we want to play as a lead into that.
Okay, sounds great.
Tracy.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land, I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning, I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters. Oh,
okay, that was Pete Seeger live. I don't know where that was. Do you know, Tracy? Does it tell you there?
It doesn't give me much details. It just says 1956.
1956, you know. Pete Seeger. Yeah. So you were going to do a reading that had to do with Royko and Pete Seeger, right?
Well, yeah, but mostly Studs and
what did Pete I Seeger. Say? Did I not say?
Well, you said Royko. But,
okay.
But Royko's part of it.
Studs is
Royko.
What I meant. Yeah.
Royko is part of it. So Studs met Pete in 1941 when Seeger was coming through Chicago with the Almanac Singers, and they didn't have a place to stay, and Studs was out with them and was the story goes, and again, Studs had this thing that truth is more important than facts, and we can talk about that if you like, but in any case, he sent them home to Ida, who worked a full-time job at 2 a.m. with a note, "These are good guys, put them up, I'll be home soon," or some such thing like that. And then they were friends, and Pete came on his show many, many, many times, and Studs was the one that nurtured Pete doing an album with Folkway Records with Big Bill Brunzi, and they truly believed that they were brothers in their belief in the everyman, that it wasn't about being a star, it wasn't about being a celebrity, it was about everybody's an artist, and artist is defined really broadly. Well, in 1981, he went on Studs' show, like I said, one of many times, but as he was doing a concert in Chicago, and Studs was the master of ceremonies at the concert, and David Royko, who was Mike Royko's son, told me the story that after the concert was over, Studs and Pete and Royko were walking up Michigan Avenue to walking Pete to his hotel, and they were probably going to make some stops on the way, I would assume, but they were walking up Michigan Avenue, and they were each carrying one of the instruments. And so this is David Royko talking. At one point, a car with the windows open started driving slowly next to them, a middle-aged couple inside staring. After a moment, the guy driving said out loud to his wife, "Oh, my God, that's Royko." And then a bit louder, "And Studs." And then almost hollering, "And oh, my God, Pete." The guy, having been at the concert, was most likely an old school liberal, and for an encore got to see a liberal Holy Trinity on Michigan Avenue. And I just thought it's sweet and kind of cute. There's not depth to it, but I think it's a great Stud story.
Getting back to our earlier religious references too. So
exactly.
Okay. Tell me what else you're doing. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. What else are you working on? I'm really interested in oral history and what that involves. And I'm curious about how that has played into your life and into your work.
Well, I think, you know, I'm loving this book more and more every time I look at it, because I'm going to go out. I'm going to go into the Midwest, you know, Chicago, obviously, and then travel for the book and hopefully come to Austin and New Orleans in the spring. But I'm leaving next month, so I'm sort of holding off of projects. I mean, the project that was the passionate project of my life before this was the book on Ruth First and Joseph Levin. I'd done oral histories in South Africa from 1999 until 2013, and it was with a great passion because I was doing it with people of different walks of life who had all fought apartheid. And part of doing oral history, this doesn't speak to method. I do talk about method in the book, but is the projects that I've picked, I get to meet such amazing people, and some of them become friends. And that was no different on the book on Stud. So I've got a number of projects in my head, which doesn't mean that I'll do any of them. But the one that keeps coming back to me is actually another South African project. There was something during apartheid called the Immorality Act about whites and blacks being together, and it ruined families, it ruined lives. And if somebody doesn't do interviews very soon, the people that were affected will be dead. I mean, just point blank, they won't be here anymore. So that's one that I keep coming back to that I think would be a very different project, because it wouldn't be people whose names you know and or names I know, but I think would be a really something that needs to be done. So basically, you know, with Studs and Ruth and Joe, I was shocked that there weren't books on either of them, on the three of them. Ruth first was assassinated in 1982. Joe Slovo died in 1995. He was a member of Mandela's first cabinet, and you know, there was nothing written about them in book form. And Studs, there was a 1990 biography, but it's kind of it's kind of the facts and the facts, and that's and I think that's about it. And I think my book's very different than that. And so it's interesting people. Studs had this thing about, you know, I interview what are considered ordinary people, but I think they're extraordinary. And the people that I interview articulate for many others. And I think by getting to do a book on Studs Terkel, I'm incredibly privileged to be able to interview and have conversations with people whose names you know, and people whose names now you only know if you read the book, because they're not known. And I mean, to sit at Quentin Young's feet and listen to him talk, even though his memory was 93, his memory wasn't all that great about Studs, but to listen to him talk about Ida and Studs, and Ida with Studs, it was a treasure, you know. And so that's why one of the reasons I do oral history.
Of course, Quentin Young had a pretty remarkable history too.
Oh, astounding, absolutely astounding. And I don't know if Quentin was Studs' doctor, and he said we never got to the stuff because all we did was talk politics, and they each blamed each other for that.
Yeah, but he was somebody who talked about healthcare, you know, in a revolutionary way, I think,
yes,
from early on.
You want to hear, do you have time for a funny story about Quentin and Obama?
Yeah, if it's about 2 minutes.
Yeah, so when I interviewed Quentin, like I said, he was in his 90s, and when we were done, I mentioned single-payer healthcare, and his eyes lit up. And he took out his flip cell phone and went to the contacts and said, "That's Barack's number. He takes my calls, but he hates it when I call." And Quentin wasn't Barack's primary doctor, but it was his partner that was Barack's doctor. So pretty interesting. And you know, and Quentin Young was like, that was my hope, and now it's not. You know, yeah. So, but yeah, just meeting these people. I mean, they're just astounding people that still have grace and hope and work hard for those possibilities.
Yeah, now Hillary says, Hillary Clinton says that she's for a public option, which is interesting, which is, of course, Bernie Sanders talking there.
Of course, of course. Studs was on some stage, and it was when Bill was running for re-election, they're lauding Bill, and Studs said, "No, you can vote for him, but you've got to criticize him. He needs to be criticized." You know? And again, maybe that's a great ending point, is my goodness, would I like to hear him talk every night instead of the people I hear talk on TV about the election.
Really, really. Okay, before we have about a minute, tell me what oral history is, what defines it. Why is it different from, say, doing interviews? I mean, what does it mean? What do you try to do? What are the academic definitions? you know,
to me, it's very similar to Stutz. It's bringing someone into a conversation, whether it's about a topic, whether it's about their life within that topic, and letting them be the person that decides what's important to them, what they want to talk about, what they don't want to talk about. And then my job as the horror historian is to sort out what works in terms of the book, article, video, whatever it is that I'm making. So I think that there, you know, I interviewed over 100 people, and I can't tell you the exact number of people who are cited or quoted or referenced in the book, but it's nowhere near 100. And from those, you go through a process, sometimes with the person, sometimes the person doesn't care, about paring down and getting to the essence of how it connects, in my case, to the topic. In Studs's book, since he did first-person oral histories, it was the story as told by the person in a kind of a full-length story, as opposed to me interviewing people as sources to write about Studs. It's a very different process. We could talk about it for 20 minutes, just that process.
There's a relatively famous Facebook page called Humans of New York, where it shows photographs and little short bios of people that he meets that day. And I guess that would be like a modern comparison.
Yeah, it's kind of a snippet kind of thing. And you know, in StoryCorps, that has places around the country where people can go in and tell their own stories. They're not edited, and it's not the same kind of thing. I mean, I do an enormous amount of editing, even when I've done first-person oral histories. And sometimes, you know, when you interview somebody, it's like we're talking now.
You got 15 seconds.
Okay, there's a stream of
consciousness. 5 seconds.
Something at the end and the beginning connect instead of it being so chronological during the interview.
Okay.
And that's the end.
Okay, that's the end. Alan Weider, author of Studs, Terkel, Politics, Culture, but Mostly Conversation. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio.